It happened in those days that a decree was sent out from Caesar Augustus to enroll the whole world. This was the first census when Quirinius was the governor of Syria, and all went to their own cities to be registered. Now Joseph also went up from the Galilee, from the city of Nazareth to Yehuda, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and family of David. He went to be enrolled with Miriam, who was engaged to him and who was pregnant. And it happened that while they were there, the days were completed for her to give birth, and she bore a son, her firstborn, and she wrapped him in swaddling cloths and laid him in a feeding trough, because there was no room for them in the inn.
Not in your bulletin is the lectionary reading for today. And when we were working out the bulletin, I was feeling a little wimpy and didn't put it in. But Matthew was yelling at me all week, and I've relented. This takes place right after the Magi visit. And having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, the Magi left for their own country by another road. Now, after they had left, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother by night, and went to Egypt, and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I have called my son." When Herod saw that he had been tricked by the Magi, he was infuriated. And he sent and killed all the children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old and under, according to the time that he had learned from the Magi. Then was fulfilled what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing and loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be consoled because they are no more. When Herod died, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared in a dream to Joseph and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who were seeking the child's life are dead." Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was ruling over Judea in the place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And after being warned in a dream, he went away to the district of Galilee. There he made his home in a town called Nazareth, so that what had been spoken through the prophets might be fulfilled. He will be called a Nazorean. So yeah, I was feeling a little wimpy after Christmas Eve about including all the readings today. Afraid because I, like most of us, I suspect, want Christmas to be sweet and lovely and when done, allow us to get back to business as usual. I didn't even put Matthew's reading in the bulletin because I was a wimp. But Matthew has been scolding me all week long because Matthew apparently didn't have any such fears about keeping Christmas sweet and lovely when he included this terrible story of the killing of all the babies under 2 years of age in Bethlehem. It's known as the slaughter of the innocents, meaning the innocent babies, but I think of it also as the slaughter of our innocents with a C-E on the end. The slaughter of any innocent illusion we might have that just because the Christ baby has come into the world, everything is going to be peaches and cream. Why would Matthew put such a horrible story at the end of his version of how Jesus came into the world? Why would he put a story like that in there? Well, because it's true to life as we know it. It's true to life as it is. The world is a harsh and a cruel place. It was when Jesus was born, and it is now. And no amount of singing "Angels We Have Heard on High" changes that fact. No amount of "Gloria in Excelsis Deo" changes that fact. And Matthew, bless his fuzzy soul, was honest enough to say it in plain and difficult speech. The Prince of Peace may have come into the world, but the princes and princesses of greed and envy and hatred are here all the same. Day before yesterday, as I was trying to figure out what to do if I was going to include this horrible reading from Matthew, I was looking at on my computer going through old sermons from 3 and 6 and 9 and 21 years ago. Holy cow. And I was startled. No, startled's not the right word. I was surprised and not surprised to find that every year when I preached on this text, I was able to lift up egregious, horrible, inhuman, and inhumane examples of the capriciousness and cruelty and needless suffering that human beings put an input upon each other. The needless suffering of the world. 21 years ago, I was talking about Bosnia and the incredible horrors happening there. And this year I can talk about the separation of families and the caging of young children at the border of our own nation this year. This picture went around the internet a few weeks ago. A church in California. Methodist church, happy to know. Of what would have happened to the Holy Family if instead of crossing the border into Egypt as refugees, they had tried to cross the border from Mexico to the United States as refugees. This is what our Christmas story would look like. How is it that we're more cruel to families in 2012, people calling themselves Christians, than a pagan king was in 4 or 6 or 7 BC? The world is a harsh place. War and death and destruction and sociopathic leadership and casual cruelty are business as usual in the world. And we don't want, or I don't want anyway, to say this or hear this on a Sunday after Christmas. Because we modern folk like our Christmas celebrations, as Gabe Huck put it, with lots of sugar. Because we live in a time when if you just watch the commercials, it looks like we live in a world that doesn't have to have a whole lot of pain and suffering. We live in a time when we expect minor illnesses to be cured in a day or two with miracle pills, and major illnesses with surgery or other medical marvels. We like the good guy to win in under 2 hours if it's at the movie theater. We want things tied up neatly and in our favor quickly. We want to hear that the Prince of Peace brings peace to our souls and to all the world as well. But that's not the true story. The truth for us is this. In the midst of a world where plenty of evil occurs, we have a chance to pause once a year next to a manger. And there we find the Prince of Peace, the love of God with 10 tiny fingers and 10 tiny toes and a scrunched up face that newborns always have for a day or two. We can listen to the angel's song. We can share in the excitement of the shepherds. We can watch with surprise and awe as magi unload their camels. We hear the good news again. God is with us. God is here. God is for us. God is here. But we have to remember that we do this knowing that when we get up and leave the stable, our regular world is still out there. It's still business as usual. We have to remember that our regular hearts are still there. And it's business as usual. Wars still rage. Children still cry. And the world will still rage and fight and be tribal and stupid and ugly. And the people we love will still get sick and die. All those hard, sad facts are still true. But when we've been to the manger, we know that those hard, sad facts are not the whole story. We know that despite all signs to the contrary, the days are numbered for the world's business is as usual. It may not be here, but we have the promise that God's realm is coming. A realm of peace, a realm of justice, a realm of mercy and compassion, and we have a calling with Jesus to help build that kingdom up. That's the story of Christmas. It's business as usual. It has numbered days. Matthew's story of the slaughter of the innocents, as difficult as it is to read, reminds us that we have a choice of how it is we respond, how it is that we're called to live. Are we to live like Herod, or are we to live like Jesus? Are we to be ruled by power, or are we to be ruled by love? Now, it may seem like an easy choice. Who would want to be as crazy and unhappy and paranoid as Herod anyway? And yet we are attracted to it. The fact that Game of Thrones ruled television for how many years shows that we have an incredible attraction to the most inhumane acts that people can do to one another. We may say, oh, I don't want to be like, remember, I can't even think of any of the characters now. And yet we watched and rooted every week. We have a choice that has some real ramifications. We can live like Game of Thrones. I'm sorry, but I just thought, if you stop someone on the street and says, do you want to live like a character in Game of Thrones, or do you want to live like Mr. Rogers, most folks are going to think Game of Thrones sounds a lot more exciting, don't you think? If you never saw Mr. Rogers sit down before the most powerful man in Congress and show why funding for PBS needed to happen, when he went up before the powers and the principalities, when he could go up before an entire racist nation and share a pool with an African-American, gay African-American opera singer playing a postal clerk on his show, quietly turning the world upside down. So maybe Mr. Rogers would be more exciting. Maya Angelou, who was poet laureate of the United States a bunch of years ago and died just this year, outlined the ramification of choosing when an interviewer asked her, why is God so crucial in your life? And she answered, the most delicious piece of knowledge for me is that I am a child of God. This is so mind-boggling that this God created everything and I am a child of God. It means that I am connected to everything and everybody. This is all delicious and wonderful until I'm forced to realize that the bigot, the brute, the batterer is also a child of God. And here she laughs. Now, he may not know he's a child of God, but I'm obligated to know that he is a child of God. I have to. That is my contract. That is my contract. To know that the one who's still following the rules of Herod is still a child of God. Even if I've decided to live like Mr. Rogers, I still have to live in a Game of Thrones world and know that every character there is too. That's the contract we all sign when we choose Jesus over Herod. We agree to recognize, as a child of God, everyone else. It's tough. You've got a laundry list of people you don't want to put on the child of God list. I mean, there's naughty and nice list, yeah, but then there's child of God and not child of God. I've got a bunch for that list. But the contract says, I erase that. I have to put them back over here. The option of living like Herod is a lot easier because you get to live by the rules of the world. But in every other sense, it's much, much worse. Here I share the words of Howard Thurman, who was the dean of chapel, an African-American professor when Martin Luther King was getting his PhD at Boston University School of Theology. And you all just read Howard Thurman book. The Jesus and the Disinherited. Thank you. And he writes this. Hate is powerful. Ask any demagogue. They know that. It is a sure but temporary form of validation. Hate crystallizes the personality and makes it possible for a vast defiance to be flung into the teeth of the destroyer. Those are the advantages of living like Herod. But Thurman continues. But Jesus said that this finally burned out all the spiritual bearings in the life of the hater and left him a charred corpse stranded on the shores of his desolate experience. He knew that love was the most completely persistent quality of which the human spirit is capable, because for its sake, people will do gladly what no power in heaven or hell could make them do without love. Hate, while it seems easy at the outset, dehumanizes and ultimately destroys the one who hates. So the question with Matthew's awful story, the question to us is, what is our back to usual? What is our back to business as usual? And I don't mean taking the tree down after Epiphany or recycling the mountains of wrapping paper and all the other stuff you have to do. What about business as usual here? We can't go back to business as usual. Or I should say, we won't go back to business as usual. Christ is born. We've been changed. Our business as usual is now Christ's business as usual. And this is what Howard Thurman said about that. And it's the next slide. Bob, can you show us that one? When the song of the angels is stilled, when the star in the sky is gone, when the kings and the princes are home, when the shepherds are back with their flocks, the work of Christmas begins. To find the lost, to heal the broken, to feed the hungry, to release the prisoner, to rebuild the nations, to bring peace among people, to make music that sounds like a child in the heart. Those are our options for business as usual. Living like Herod, living like Game of Thrones, living like House of Cards, or living like Jesus. It's going to be New Year's Eve. I hear that's a good day to work out what direction we're thinking about. Which will I be in 2020? A Herod follower? It can be attractive. I get to be the hard-headed cynic who doesn't get fooled by anything. I'll never be taken advantage of. I won't get fooled again. But who will be eaten from inside? Or will I be a Jesus follower? A visionary who might get taken advantage of, who might play the fool, who might be seen as a naive, but a visionary who knows that God will triumph, that a kingdom is coming, and I'm going to work toward it. Which will we be? Amen.